I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Biden warned the nation last night in an address from Independence Hall here in Philadelphia that our democracy is under assault. He said the Republican Party is dominated, driven, and intimidated by former President Trump and people he calls the MAGA Republicans.
MAGA Republicans do not respect the Constitution. They do not believe in the rule of law. They do not recognize the will of the people. They refuse to accept the results of a free election, and they're working right now, as I speak, in state after state, to give power to decide elections in America to partisans and cronies, empowering election deniers to undermine democracy itself.
Biden went on declaring that blind loyalty to a single leader and a willingness to engage in political violence is fatal to democracy. He said, you can't be pro-insurrectionist and pro-American.
We saw law enforcement brutally attacked on January 6th. We've seen election officials, poll workers, many of them volunteers of both parties, subject to intimidation and death threats. And can you believe it? FBI agents just doing their job as directed, facing threats to their own lives from their own fellow citizens.
Now, last night, Trump said he would issue a full pardon and government apology to the rioters who attacked the Capitol on January 6th if he were reelected. Trump and his supporters continue to lie about the results of the 2020 election and feed conspiracy theories about voter fraud. Here's what Biden said last night about that.
Democracy cannot survive when one side believes there are only two outcomes to an election. Either they win or they were cheated. And that's where the MAGA Republicans are today. They don't understand what every patriotic American knows. You can't love your country only when you win.
Biden chose Independence Hall in Philadelphia because of its historical significance. Pennsylvania is also Biden's second of three stops in Pennsylvania in a week. Trump will be in Wilkes-Barre tomorrow on Saturday, underscoring the importance of the Commonwealth on the national political front and the two statewide races for U.S. Senate and governor. We have a lot to talk about, and we have three guests who have joined us on Radio Times. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Neil Oxman. He's president of the Campaign Group. That's a media strategist organization helping Democrats. He's been doing this. The campaign group has been around since 1980. Neil Oxman usually comes in to talk about movies. We're going to talk about politics. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning. And also with us, Jonathan Tamara. He's national political reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Jonathan, nice to have you back with us.
Thanks, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you with us. He joined us by Skype. And Erin Haynes rounding out our trio of guests. She is editor-at-large at the 19th, also contributing editor to A More Perfect Union, also at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Erin Haynes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Marty, good to be with you. Happy Labor Day weekend.
Yes, exactly. We're off to a great start. Well, let me just get, and I'll start with you, Neil, only because you're sitting across from me here in Philadelphia, just a couple of blocks from where the president gave his speech. It sounded like a different kind of Joe Biden in terms of his delivery, in terms of the language that he used, in terms of his tone. What do you think is happening with him?
Well, he's not on the defensive. I mean, you know, during COVID and gas being $5 a gallon, clearly his administration has been on the defensive, starting with Roe a few months ago and now inflation getting a little bit better, especially with energy prices. And thirdly, sort of Trump beginning to unravel after Mar-a-Lago, you know, they feel that it's time to go on the offensive for two reasons. A few months ago, Biden's numbers among Democrats weren't where they were when he was elected in 2000. His favorable and unfavorable wasn't that great among Democrats. It's starting to come back. And the other thing they've seen is that independents are sort of – and he was doing horribly with independents months ago. They're now, you know, beginning to come around. And it was a speech designed to do two things. It was really three things. One, making sure the Democratic base and was shored up, which probably will happen 9 weeks from Tuesday when the election is. Two, you know, encircling independents around this thought that the object is to isolate MAGA Republicans as some small group of extremists that are outside the mainstream of American thought. And I think he did a really good job of that, and much better than he's been and the White House has been for months.
Well, Jonathan, let me get you in on the conversation as well. As someone who covers politics and has been covering Biden, what did you hear last night?
I heard a lot of what Neil just described. I think build on what he said, what you're seeing is him basically trying to reframe the stakes of this election this fall, I think, in that usually a midterm election is going to be a referendum on the party in power, especially in a situation like this where you've got Democrats controlling the White House and Congress. They've been able to advance not all of their agenda for sure, but certainly pieces of it. And typically in November, the voters would come out and decide whether they give that a thumbs up or thumbs down. And even though Biden's polls have ticked upwards a bit, they're still mostly getting a thumbs down from people overall. What he was doing was basically saying, listen, this isn't just about me. This is about the choice between me and what's on the other side. And so trying to change the election from a referendum on Biden into a choice between him and what he describes as the MAGA Republicans.
Aaron, let me pick up on something that Neil's referenced, which was the Supreme Court overturning Roe. And I wonder whether you think that is going to change some of the political calculations, the fact that women no longer have the right to choose.
It absolutely is going to change the calculations. We're already seeing that having an effect here in the Commonwealth and across the country. The Inquirer had a story that really was eye-popping for me, talking about how Pennsylvania has had one of the nation's biggest gender gaps in new voter registrations, women outpacing men by about 12 points in new registrations on the other side of the Dobbs decision. And so 62% of those women registering since Dobbs were registered as Democrats, wow. 15% as Republicans, 54% younger than 25. And so this is absolutely an issue that is galvanizing women. But I will say, the choice conversation, the shift from a referendum election to a choice election, so much of that is being driven by women, not only on the idea of abortion as a conversation about freedom and access to freedom and rights, but also the threat to democracy, which is also something where we're seeing in polls. People's reaction to that has also been gendered, with women being very concerned about the threats to democracy that continue to loom 2 years after the big lie continues to really perpetuate in our politics.
Well, and not surprisingly, Neil, Republicans are pushing back. McCarthy said that it was Biden that was issuing an assault on democracy. McDaniel called him the divider in chief. Does this sort of frame where things are going to go from here,
you
politically
know,
speaking?
The Republicans have allowed Trump to really mishandle this thing in one sense. When we poll, the very first question we ask is, are you registered to vote? And if somebody says they're not registered to vote, we don't talk to them. Then they say, what are your likelihood of voting? And if somebody says they're just fair or poor, we say, thanks. And then the first substantive question we ask is, do you think things in the country are going in the right direction or the wrong track? That's sort of the EKG. And America right now, all Americans, including Democrats, the number is 70% wrong track, 30% right direction. That usually says the party in power should be gone. I mean, there's that is just the big – if you were a doctor and you looked at, you know, that's your temperature being 104, there's something wrong. There's a lot of white blood cells in your you know, blood tests. What – you know, they've allowed themselves to be dominated by Trump and have Trump insinuate himself in this election to the degree where, you know, this has not become, as Jonathan said, a referendum on Biden and right direction, wrong track of the country. It's – you know, there are 100 other things going on. Democracy, Roe v. Wade, Trump, Mar-a-Lago. I mean, all this other stuff that doesn't do well for Republicans right now, which is why pundits have now said – there are not going to be any Democratic turnovers at the governor's race. We could hold on to the Senate. The you know, they were predicting 248 House Republican seats. It's now down to 226. And on top of it, one of the big things, because it was horrible during Obama, we lost over 900 legislative seats. We have a chance to pick up 200 to 300 legislative seats around the country, which really helps.
Well, and picking up on that, and Jonathan, going back to you, and even what the president was saying last night about democracy being under assault, according to an NBC poll, Americans put democracy under threat as number one, followed by inflation. A Quinnipiac poll found that 67% of Americans think the nation's democracy is in danger of collapse. Now, that doesn't mean they agree politically, but nonetheless, this seems like it's a pretty serious issue.
Yeah, and it's definitely risen as a salient issue. There's been a feeling, I think, for a long time that it wasn't necessarily resonating as much as some people thought. I think the January 6th committee hearings have probably elevated the issue significantly for a lot of voters. I do think that there is still a note of caution in that when there are a lot of people who say that democracy is under threat, a lot of those are Democrats who believe it's under threat from Republicans, but there are Republicans who are answering that it's under threat from President Biden. So it doesn't necessarily mean that all those voters are going to hear Biden's message yesterday and suddenly decide that they have to vote for Democrats to protect democracy. Many are coming away with the opposite conclusion. But for a Democrat, I think they see the threat to democracy and the attempts, the clear attempts to overturn the 2020 election, the Capitol riot, the attempts of election deniers to gain more power in these midterm elections. They tie that all in. They link that to the overturning of Roe v. Wade and other issues as a constellation, in their view, of Republican extremism. And that's kind of, I think, how they're going to try to pull that all together as we approach these midterm, the November election.
Aaron, about a minute before a break here, but and I don't mean to throw like a big question at you, like, are we in a civil war? But nonetheless, you know, we have in the past been at each other's throats about a whole host of issues. How do you see the mood of the country today?
Yeah, I mean, well, look, you've had Neil and Jonathan both kind of talking about the idea that you have Republicans, Democrats, people of no stripe saying that they feel that the country is headed in the wrong direction, and that means different things depending on who you ask, and you know who's to blame for that also depends on who you ask, whether that is President Biden or former President Trump in voters' minds. But you know, I think 2 years in, what last night's speech showed us is that the president is clear that this battle for the soul of America that launched his campaign is something that is still very much underway, and the unity and bipartisanship that he was hoping for at the beginning of his presidency is something that is still pretty far off. And you know, we are at an inflection point, he was saying it in terms of where we want to go as a country. In 2019, when he launched his campaign, he said, this is not who we are. And I think in 2022, what he is saying is, well, this is who some of us are, but who do the rest of us want to be?
Fair enough. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Aaron Haynes. Also with us, Jonathan Tamari and Neil Oxman. We are talking about the president's speech last night in Philadelphia, also talking about threats to our democracy. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and again, we are talking about President Biden's speech last night in Philadelphia in front of Independence Hall, talking about the state of our politics. Are we in a civil war or heading in that direction? We'll also be talking about some of the really fascinating races here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Again, our guests are Neil Oxman, president of the campaign group. Also with us, Jonathan Tamari, national political reporter at the Philadelphia Philadelphia Inquirer, and Aaron Haynes, editor-at-large at The 19th. Let me read some comments here, and then I want to toss some questions around. Phil says, what kind of nuance is employed in asking respondents if the country is going in the right direction? If you are just asking that plain question, I imagine folks on both sides would say no. And I think we touched on that right before the break. Jim says, for 18 months, I've been waiting for Biden to stand up and say this. It has taken him too long to do it. He has allowed the far right to spread the lies, and it's about time. An email from a listener, President Biden proved he is the man for the country. Democrats must not weaken him and allow the GOP to destroy America. One more from Paul McCarthy says, Biden should apologize for insulting Republicans. In my opinion, Kevin McCarthy should apologize to the entire country. In fact, the entire Republican Party, except for Cheney and Kissinger, should apologize to the American people for destroying the courts and enabling Trump, giving our listeners a feel for how people are reacting to our conversation. Neil, let me pick up on something that Aaron was saying before the break, and I don't want to use the word civil war casually or cavalierly, but what do you, Marty, I'm old enough to remember the 60s, and we certainly have had.
As a one aside, what's really interesting is, because you and I are the same age, when we protested Vietnam, the liberals were the ones who were anti-FBI and J. Edgar Hoover, and it's really turned full cycle.
It sure has.
You know, and where Reagan and all these guys fought the Cold War, now you have Fox News and all these people embracing autocrats like it's nothing, like the Cold War didn't exist.
Topsy-turvy.
I think that the Civil War, a seed of the Civil War, if there is going to be one, and I hope there isn't going to be, I used to think that there would be one. There would be civil unrest in the country between the haves and the have-nots. That the have-nots would have had enough of this income gap, and there would be some real civil disobedience in the country. I mean, I was always afraid of that. But I think that the seed and the genesis of this happened when an African-American man was elected president of the United States. Two blocks from here, in 1787, when the Constitution was written, the only people who could vote in the country were white men,
right.
White men property owners. I mean, you know, women couldn't vote until the 20th century. There are a lot of people in the country who couldn't accept Obama, including, you know, Trump doing this insane stuff where he wasn't even born in the United States. And then you had on top of it, you know, these quotas. COVID to the right was an assault on freedom. I mean, that's what it was about. It wasn't about, you know, trying to protect people. I mean, 1 million people in the United States have died of COVID. You know, and there have been articles in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times about how life expectancy among all races in the country has dropped in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people out there, and it's not five. There used to be the John Birch Society and 5% of Americans that we keep. You know, we might think is kind of kooky on the right. It's a little bit more with Q and all this stuff where. You know, what do you say to people if you nicely say to somebody, today is Friday? Today's Friday. And they don't believe today is Friday. No matter what you say to them, they don't believe today is Friday. Because Q says it's not Friday, and Trump says it's not Friday, and the internet says it's not Friday because it's come from who knows where. It's really hard to see where this is going to come together for a while. And you're spending $5 for a gallon of gas, so yep. There's something real happening.
Jonathan, let me go back to you. And Aaron, I have lots of questions for you as well. But it's interesting to hear Biden use things like MAGA Republicans. I mean, he's trying to sort of separate them out. But nonetheless, he talks about how they sort of have taken control of the party. He talked about, you know, fascism light or semi-fascism. He's using very strong language. Where do you think that comes from for him? And this is, of course, a guy who talks about my friends on the – or used to talk about my friends on the other side.
Yeah, I mean, he spent much of his first 2 years in office trying to get Republicans to come along with some pieces of his agenda. And I imagine that if Democrats maintain control of one of the chambers of Congress, he'll try to do it again come January. But it might be a lot more difficult after some of this rhetoric. I think some of it – he seemed to really believe during his last campaign that if Trump was defeated, things would change for the Republican Party and the party would be different when he was in office. And there were a lot of people on the left who kind of criticized him for saying that and believing that and thinking that was naive. And he seems to maybe have come around to their way of thinking, especially after seeing the primaries this year, when by and large, the people who embraced Trump did far, far better than the people who rejected him. And so he seems to have concluded that there is not an ability to work with those types of Republicans, and to frame this as a choice between him and them.
Aaron, let me pick up on something that that Neil said about Obama, the election of our first black president, that sort of opened up or unlocked, whether you call it racism or a certain hatred of the other or the kind of turmoil that we're in. Do you see it that way?
Definitely. I mean, I think the history of our country tells us that there is no kind of racial progress, right? You have the election of the first black president in this country without backlash. That happened, you know, after the Civil War. That happened, you know, during in the wake of the Civil Rights Movement and of what led up to the Civil Rights Movement, and it's happening. It happened certainly in 2008, and that you know, culminated in many ways with the election of the former president, who even in his 2016 election raised the specter of a rigged election in cities where you had large populations of black voters basically trying to negate their votes even in his victory. And so, you know, that has only metastasized, you know, since the 2016 election. And, you know, to Jonathan's point, President Biden certainly thought, I think, that with his election, the big lie would kind of pass from the scene. But even though the former president is out of office, he is absolutely not out of power. And so you have President Biden now trying to frame this as not about what former President Trump does, but what do we as Americans do to reject the big lie and to continue to move in the direction of progress and equality.
Neil, we were talking about this actually before going on the air about the fact that it's been, what, a year and a half since Biden got elected, and Trump still dominates our consciousness, our airwaves, our politics, our news cycles. Are we stuck with this guy?
Well, I mean, if he announces for president, yes. I mean, you know, it would be an interesting academic discussion would be what happens if somebody, Nikki Haley, or somebody who's semi-reasonable, she's reasonable, gets Trump one-on-one in a Republican primary. But, you know, you have Larry Hogan and you have a whole bunch of people posturing out there to run, and maybe Liz Cheney. And so if it's a crowded field in the Republican primary, there's 5, 6, 7 people. I mean, they had a dozen last time or more. You know, they didn't have enough desks on the stage to have people in one debate. You know, if you have that, Trump wins the primary easily, and it continues and it goes on. And I don't know what effect the investigation's going to have, and whether or not he's going to be indicted for whatever he could be indicted for. But yes, I mean, he will. You know, he will continue to dominate this as long as he decides to stay active. You know, I mean, look at all these people that just go to Mar-a-Lago to kiss his ring and to get. I mean, as Jonathan said, the pro-Trump people overwhelmingly won Republican primaries this cycle than the anti-Trump people. A few anti-Trumpers held on, but mostly it was pro-Trump people.
And that is Neil Oxman, again, president of the campaign group here in Philadelphia. Jonathan Tamari joining us by Skype. He's national political reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Erin Haynes also joining us, and she is editor at large for the 19th, also contributing editor to A More Perfect Union. That's a series at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Again, talking about President Biden's speech last night. Talking obviously about former President Donald Trump and the state of our politics. And we do want to talk about what's happening here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania when it comes to a U.S. Senate race and also race for governor. Let me just make sure you can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Here's a tweet from Max. Stop regarding seeing the United States as a democracy or the state of our democracy. We are a republic. There is a difference, and it matters. I'll just leave that out there. Jonathan, let me turn to you, and I mentioned this in my introduction. Biden will be in Pennsylvania, I think, three times over the course of a week. He obviously was in Philadelphia last night. He's going out to Pittsburgh for Labor Day. Donald Trump is going to be, I believe, in Wilkes-Barre on Saturday. So you've got, you know, four big-name political people in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania over the course of a week. What does that tell us?
Well, it just confirms that Pennsylvania is possibly the premier battleground in the country, if not one of the top two or three, both in 2022, and it will be again in 2024 for the presidential race. When you look up and down the ballot this year, this race is for governor, for Senate, for Congress. Are all going to be hugely impactful, both in control of Congress and for the laws in the state. You know, the next governor will likely be able to sign or veto new abortion restrictions, given that there's a conservative state legislature. They'll have the signature or the veto over voting rights, and they will oversee the conduct of the 2024 presidential election. And, you know, we saw that a Democratic administration in 2020 was able to resist the pressure that came from Trump to try to stop the count in Philadelphia and try to, you know, reverse the results. The gubernatorial candidate now for the Republicans, Doug Mastriano, would seem much more amenable to that. So the stakes are just tremendous for both this year and for 2024, when Biden and Trump could theoretically both be back on the ballot.
And Aaron, just talking about the race for governor, the governor also appoints a secretary of state. I think that's what Jonathan was referring to in terms of managing essentially the next election. How do you see that race?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we've already heard Doug Mastriano, you know, saying that he would not be opposed to challenging those election results, picking a secretary of state who's going to, you know, kind of make the right decision, whatever that means in terms of how elections would go going forward. And so, you know, the big lie and the idea, the false idea that our elections are rigged or fraudulent, when we know that there is overwhelming evidence that there's, you know, little to no voter fraud in our country's elections. You know, this has implications. It wasn't just about 2020. It's about 2022, 2024, and beyond.
Neil, you want to add to that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This is another place where Republicans really fumbled the ball. My company has been involved in literally more statewide campaigns than anybody else since 1980. But in Pennsylvania, we've done races in about 40-some states, but in Pennsylvania. When we did Rendell's campaign for governor in 2022, there were 2002.
Time flies.
There were almost 900,000 more Democrats in the state than Republicans. Now it's 550,000. I mean, there have been, you know, a closing of the registration gap. And if the Republicans had nominated a Tom Ridge, Dick Thornburg, Hugh Scott, Schweiker, you know, type Republican nominee for governor, you know, I still think Josh Shapiro would win. But it would be, you know, much more competitive than it is now. And the same thing at the Senate race. I mean, Dr. Oz has run for a competitive campaign. I mean, there have been walkovers. John Hines beating Joe Vignola was a walkover. There are, you know, when Rendell beat Lynn Swann or Wolf's reelection essentially were walkovers. I mean, Dr. Oz isn't a walkover, and he's run one of the worst campaigns there is. I mean, if the Republicans had nominated, you know, some moderate Republican congressman, not that there are many left, you know, or some, you know, they would have a chance in these statewides, but they've nominated these Trump kooks who really are so far out of the mainstream, who make Toomey and Santorum look like rational Republicans.
Hmm. And Jonathan, my understanding is that both Mastriano and Oz will be with Trump in Wilkes-Barre tomorrow and Saturday.
Yes, they're scheduled to both be there. They were both endorsed by Trump. You know, the Oz endorsement was very significant. He won his primary by fewer than 1,000 votes. So you've got to think that the endorsement of the former president and the most popular Republican within the party was instrumental in a race that's that close. And he really needs help kind of rallying the Republican base, according to most public polling. You know, there are a lot of questions about him, about some statements he's made in the past that were more moderate on a number of social issues. He had to kind of prove himself to be conservative, and he's used Trump's endorsement to really kind of try to seal the deal with Republican voters and prove to them that he is a conservative. But he still needs to, he's still working to do that at this stage. And so that's why I think it's probably important for him to be there. The challenge, of course, being the closer you get to Trump, the more you may turn off a lot of those swing voters who rejected him in 2020.
And Aaron, I think it was the Daily Beast found a clip where Oz talked about abortion as murder.
Yeah, that was right. They had that clip in that story. But you have somebody like a Dr. Oz. You have other Republican candidates. You've actually got a story out on the 19th right now talking about the Republican candidates who are kind of walking back some of those extreme comments and views that they have previously made, because these extreme views are being met with rejection by a lot of even Republican voters who may think that some of those views go further than their feelings and sentiments about abortion and abortion rights, even if they, maybe folks who are against abortion. They think that some of the kind of extreme positions, not, you know, no exceptions for rape or incest or life of the mother are acceptable. And so I think, that story coming out is something that mm-hmm. would, could resonate with some voters here in Pennsylvania who are already alarmed at the, you know, at what the future of in the post-Dobbs reality is going to be on access to abortion and reproductive rights.
Neil, we're almost up in a break here, but quickly, do you think, as you know, Pennsylvania, do you think abortion will be, and we've got candidates that are almost diametrically opposed on this particular issue.
I think clearly abortion has galvanized women because of the extreme positions of the Republicans. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, Aaron was talking about registration changes, and of course, there is a registration gap historically. Lately, it's been, you know, Republicans with men and Democrats with women, but it is absolutely mm-hmm. going to help.
And that is Neil Oxman, also with us, Jonathan Tamari, and Aaron Haynes. And again, we've shifted gears, but we will still be continuing our conversation talking about politics today on Radio Times. We began talking about President Biden's speech just a couple of blocks away in Philadelphia in front of Independence Hall, where he sounded the alarm about the state of our democracy. Also talking about a couple of key races here in Pennsylvania. And again, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let me read a couple of more comments. A listener tweet, he says, or she says, Trump dominates the airwaves because the media loves an entertainer more than it does a producer. Oz was a media hero, while the developers of the COVID vaccine go unheralded, superficial. Steve says, Christian nationalism is fueling the MAGA movement. The Civil War never ended. This is a resurgence. Scott says, I voted for Biden, but every time I hear everything I hear on the air is one-sided. Clearly, today's program's guests have the same view. Why do we not have MAGA Republicans included in these conversations? It's wrong. We are talking about them. To you, Scott, we have had MAGA Republicans on this show and Republicans on this show. In fact, did a show not so long ago with Republicans talking to each other about their party and the state of politics. So that is why we had the guests that we had today. Aaron, let me pick up on something. Both you and Neil were talking about abortion, but I wonder whether when Roe was the law of the land, it was possible to have really extreme views, for instance, that a 14-year-old rape victim, you know, should carry her child to term. But without Roe, then people have to actually defend that position because that could become the law of the land. Has that changed the calculation?
Well, I do think that hearing as we are increasingly hearing stories in a post-Dobbs reality of some of these extreme cases where you have young girls that are having to grapple with this, you know, just very difficult decision, or even, you know, women who are having miscarriages who are running up against trigger laws that are taking effect in states across the country in the wake of Dobbs. These are kind of, you know, we didn't exactly know how this was going to play out or what it was going to look like. But I think that as the reality is coming into sharper and sharper focus for the country and people are grappling with the very real world results of this Supreme Court decision, it is really galvanizing a lot of women, but also men too, from pollsters that I'm hearing from who are saying that this is scary and this seems like a bridge too far that they do not want. I mean, 2/3 of women alive today in this country have always lived under the federal protections that Roe provided, and now that they are gone, I think that this has been a real wake-up call to them to what a post-Roe, a world without Roe really looks like.
Jonathan, let me ask you, actually all three of you, but I'm interested, I'll start with you, about the Fetterman-Oz race. We talked a little bit about Dr. Oz, who I know he said he does want to debate Fetterman, something that Fetterman declined to do. This would have been sometime early this month. What do you make of these two candidates and how this race is going?
Well, so far, Fetterman, according to all polling, has a fairly solid lead, although the more recent polls have been a lot tighter than some of the ones earlier in the summer. And if you talk to both campaigns, they'll tell you that kind of is more in line with what they're seeing internally, that it is Fetterman with the lead, but not a tremendous one. When it comes to the debates, you know, it's typical. There's almost always a debate about debates, and whoever is the front runner is trying to play down the debates because they don't want to change the status quo, and whoever's trailing wants to have more and more debates because they want to try to trip up the person they're trying to catch. In this case, you've got the complicating factor of Fetterman's health and the fact that he had a stroke and clearly is still having trouble sometimes with some of his speech. He says that he's having trouble with hearing, with audio processing. And so there's an added layer to it that, you know, Oz is using to say, well, maybe this raises questions about whether Fetterman is healthy enough for the job or is more sick than he's letting on. And Fetterman is saying that, look, Oz is trying to basically bully somebody over a health condition. And just lastly, I would say it's worth keeping in mind when Fetterman during the primary, we saw this play out as well. Before his stroke, he also kind of wanted to put off the debates with his Democratic primary opponent. So that's not new, but you do have the added layer of his health now being an issue as well.
Are debates important, Neil?
Yes, there have been. I mean, certainly at the presidential level, there have been a lot of times where debates have been one of the defining moments of a campaign, a little less so in statewide races, but they are important. I mean, the problem with statewide races, they're not necessarily in prime time, cut across every TV station so that, you know, they don't get the kind of ratings that presidential debates do. It's interesting. Fetterman's stroke was 15 weeks ago today.
Oh, I mean,
it's 15, you know, and it's been a long time. And the debate he did do in the primary, he did not do well. He wasn't great. The good thing for Fetterman is, and I've been tracking this for a long time, in the modern history of polling in Pennsylvania, no one, even after they've lost a landslide, I mean, Rick Santorum lost his reelection in 2006 to Bob Casey, young Bob Casey for the United States Senate, by the second largest landslide an incumbent United States senator has lost since the Second World War. Even his numbers were not as bad as the polling numbers, the favorable, unfavorable, that Oz had right after the primary. His numbers were 28 to 50 upside down, meaning 28% of people were favorable, 50 unfavorable. I mean, he had an onslaught of media from McCormick. I mean, here's a guy who started at 30 and no one knew outside of, you know, his family who McCormick was. McCormick was a zero for all intents and purposes. Oz was at 30 and he ended up getting 30. He won by 910 votes. And so, you know, it's been really hard for Oz to move away from the fact that for somebody who was very popular, you know, last December, the overwhelming favorite is less popular now, even among Republicans. He's got a 35% negative among Republicans, which is really, really hard for him to do. And he also has made the campaign about the wrong thing. I mean, calling Fetterman a radical and socialist and all this stuff. I mean, you know, stand next to a gas pump and say, you know, this is what we have to change. Go into a grocery store and don't talk about crudité or anything else. You know, check out a dozen eggs. But what Fetterman has done, Fetterman is not a politician. I mean, he, you know, doesn't look like a politician. He doesn't act like a politician. He's become a cult figure. And because he's become a cult figure, he really is Teflon-like from these accusations that Oz has thrown at him. And so you have the race where I think in the end, even a really bad turnout model, you know, Fetterman and Shapiro will both win by 5 to 8 points. I mean, decent, comfortable wins.
How do you see this race, Aaron? Curious.
Well, you know, I just want to make a comment on the debate question, Marty, and that is, you know, I think these debates will matter for voters who are wanting to know where these candidates stand on issues like abortion and on issues like what they would do about election results. And, you know, this is a race, I mean, the governor's race and the Senate race here in Pennsylvania are both races that are in the national spotlight. So, while money certainly doesn't translate into votes necessarily, we like to remind people of that. These debates that are really showing kind of the stark contrast and the stakes in these races, I'm certain, you know, these candidates are going to be using, you know, that debate footage to raise money to fuel their campaign to get them across the finish line to victory.
And Jonathan, do we have any sense about the money that will be spent or has been spent on these races?
Well, there's a ton of money being spent. Fetterman has been kind of a fundraising juggernaut from when he got into this campaign early in 2021, and he's got this base of small donors, largely Pennsylvania, but now increasingly across the country. Now that he's won the nomination, that are really fueling his campaign. Oz has not raised as much money. He paid for the primary campaign mostly out of his own pocket, and I think that there's a number of donors who kind of expect him to do the same this time around. The national parties are going to come in with huge money because of the stakes, but right now, actually, the National Republican Party has had to cut back, given that they have really struggled to match Democratic fundraising. And in Pennsylvania, it's such a huge state. It's not the kind of state you can win just by knocking on doors. You need to be on television with so many markets. Money can be a very big factor, even if it's not the only factor.
Well, and just to underscore, I think the importance of this race, Neil, is we're talking about an open seat in what is essentially a 50-50 Senate in D.C. and with Toomey retiring, so that the stakes for both parties,
because it would be a Democrat if Fetterman wins, it's a Democratic pickup. I mean, right. And there aren't that many opportunities around the country, only really four or five that you could have Democratic pickups to sort of keep the Senate as Democratic. You know, the Oz is by every measure has. His campaign has not been as well run as Fetterman. I mean, he's really been on the defensive the whole time from the primary on. And so, you know, I don't know whether he can turn the debate around it right, you know, at this point. You know, he will try, but I don't know if they can. And of course, I mean, Jonathan is right. I mean, I think Jonathan and his colleagues have done an amazing job covering for the last year plus both the Senate and the governor's races, from the primaries to the general. I mean, they've given an unbelievable amount of coverage, which doesn't necessarily happen in every statewide campaign. I mean, it's happened a lot more this cycle. The Inquirer's done a really, really wonderful job of it. But the Oz is very frustrated about what he's doing. And you see now he's trying to soften his image, talking about being a doctor, after medical school in Philadelphia and you know, trying to do something different than he's been doing before.
Mm. Well, and let me give a shout out to my colleagues here at WHYY who have also been covering these important races in Pennsylvania. Though, just a quick follow up to you, though, Neil. I mean, can you tweet and essentially troll your way to victory?
Well, yes, people are talking about that. John and the Inquirer has written about that. But on top of it, he's spending $1 million TV statewide because he's raised almost $30 million. So that the teasing and the, you know, running an airplane down the Jersey Shore with all the stuff and having all the kind of silly fun stuff that's not part of a usual debate is really – it's part of what's going on, but what's really going on is $1 million a week TV plus buy from the hard side of the Fetterman campaign and the majority PAC on the Democratic side spending a ton of money. And so, you know, at this point, the Fetterman and the Democrats are overwhelmingly spent the Republicans in Oz here, and that's what the campaign is about right now.
Aaron, this is I Googled this. Like, how many women have been governors of Pennsylvania? I believe it's zero.
Correct. You knew.
Correct. And how many women have represented Pennsylvania in the U.S. Senate? I believe the answer is also zero.
Correct.
What's wrong with this state? Why can't we elect a woman to a statewide race?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think when you talk about electability, the issue of, I think voters not only in the Commonwealth, but really across the country are fine with women being in kind of collaborative positions of leadership, right? Serving in a state legislature, for example, or serving as a member of Congress. But when it comes to women actually leading, being the executive, right, being a governor, being president of the United States, voters are not quite yet ready to make that leap, or at least they've shown that they are not quite ready, that their political imagination is not such that they really see a woman as somebody that they want leading our state, our country. Frankly, our Philadelphia has never had a woman mayor, by the way. So, you know, I think the question of electability as it pertains to gender is certainly one that we still ponder at the 19th, 102 years after suffrage. We just got through, marking the anniversary of the 19th Amendment last month, for which my newsroom is named. And women's representation, while it has certainly increased in our politics, we still have quite a ways to go in terms of making gains in our highest political offices in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania and across the country.
And Jonathan, from your perch as you cover Pennsylvania politics, is there an explanation for this?
Well, I think it's a very culturally conservative state, and I think you have, you know, a lot of kind of, it's only ever had white men elected to the Senate. So I think it's just a state where there are a lot of people. I mean, clearly there are a lot of people, few would say it, but clearly the fact that it's never happened suggests there's a lot of people who are reluctant to elect a woman to an executive position, as Aaron just pointed out.
You agree? I mean,
yeah, no, we only have 3 female members of Congress. We still have a legislature and a state Senate that has, 53% of the population of Pennsylvania are female. And we don't remotely have that kind of representation, even though, you know, and I'm one, you know, Bill Green famously years ago called Philadelphia City Council the worst legislative body in the free world. I believe it's the state House and state Senate in Pennsylvania. I mean, it's not even close. And, but the state has always been a patriarchy. You know, it is what it is. We always had one. Well, there are 2 things historically. We always had one-term governors, and a lot of the one-term governors were the governor was of one party, then the lieutenant governor happened to be of the same party, became the nominee for the Democrats, Republicans, and then you had a turnover. Remember, in Pennsylvania, nationally, we didn't have popular elections in the Senate until 1912. The legislatures chose the senators. I mean, so that, you know, and in Pennsylvania, the coal and steel and railroad interests chose the senators. I mean, that's what it was. I mean,
that is 100 years ago.
Right. But I mean, it's just insane that it has now because women haven't become state reps and then state senators and then members of Congress and then candidates for governor and senator. I mean, Alison Schwartz was one of the few who sort of went up the race, but unfortunately didn't run a very good gubernatorial campaign.
Yeah. Well, we got to leave it there. Neil Oxman, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Jonathan Tamari, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. And Aaron Haynes, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. Enjoy your holiday.
Yeah, you too. It's Labor Day weekend. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, you can go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we got a bunch of them there. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.